You are listening to the podcast That's Life in Sweden, or as we say in Swedish, Sånt är livet i Sverige, with me, your host, Lisa Orsimäki. And I would like to welcome Noella McKenzie to the program. Noella is an independent education consultant, a senior fellow of the Australian Literacy Educators, and adjunct associate professor in the School of Education at Charles Sturt University, New South Wales, here in Australia. She is passionate about teaching and in particular early literacy development. Her research focuses on literacy teaching and learning, and in particular, writing acquisition. So in this episode and via the mobile, we will explore Noella's journey from classroom teacher to an independent education consultant. Hello, Noella. How are you this morning?
I'm very well. Thank you, Lisa. How are you?
I'm good. It's a beautiful morning here in Melbourne.
Yes, it's going to be a lovely day here, although there's a little bit of rain at the moment.
Oh, okay. And you are, of course, situated in Albury.
That's correct, on the New South Wales-Victorian border, about 3.5 hours by car north of Melbourne.
And here in Melbourne, we're going to have a very noisy weekend with a Grand Prix.
Oh, that'll be very exciting. I know they've been waiting for it to return.
Yes, and I know there are a lot of people who are so passionate about cars, and well, it's not really my area of interest. And I know you have, well, I don't know, are you interested in cars?
No. Well, except I want a reliable, comfortable car that gets me from A to B.
That's me. So, I mean, being educators, I think we have a different kind of passion. And I know you have a passion for teaching and learning, and in particularly literacy development. And I know you have written extensively in this area. And so just to get a sense of who you are, and can you share what prompted your interest in the area of literacy development?
I guess there's a number of things that come into play here. The first is I grew up on a farm and I went to the local primary and high school in a small town in a rural area of New South Wales, the fourth child born of five. My father was required to leave school at 14 to work on the family farm. And my mother completed year 11, worked in a bank before marrying Dad. Her role after marrying was the farm and her family. Both very articulate, interested people who were not highly educated, but were interested in the world around them and further afield. I think I knew from quite an early age that I was fortunate to be strong at all literacy skills. And I seemed to have an understanding from quite a young age that this gave me an advantage in school and it would impact my future, taking me beyond the farm and the small town. I always knew my parents expected me to do well at school, but I wasn't really sure what they expected beyond school, as this was never a topic of conversation at home. I was only able to train as a teacher because of a scholarship that covered all my fees and living expenses. I wasn't even sure I'd like teaching until I had my own class in my first year of teaching. Then I knew that teaching was the best career choice ever. Fast forward, I have a number of diplomas and degrees earned across a 27-year time period, culminating in a doctorate achieved when I was 48. My career has been rich and varied, working for the most part in Australia, but also with stints in California and Canada. Three distinct stages, I guess, teaching in primary schools, working with teachers with a focus on literacy learning, and finally academia. My research started with my master's and doctorate before going to the university and continued in my academic role. Was I lucky? Maybe. But none of these opportunities would have been possible without strong literacy skills. I believe that literacy is central to all learning and therefore life opportunities. And the UNESCO definition of literacy makes that very clear. And I quote, "Literacy involves a continuum of learning to enable an individual to achieve his or her goals, to develop his or her knowledge and potential, and to participate fully in the wider society." This says to me that literacy is an equity issue, and we owe it to do our best to support all children in their endeavours to become literate. I think I had an instinct about this for a long time before I actually knew the research behind literacy learning. But James Heckman determined some years back that an investment in early childhood literacy was one of the best investments that could be made, as it had direct impact on a child's future prospects. He identified high economic returns for investments in the literacy learning of young disadvantaged children. But he also warned that any early investment needed to be followed up and maintained across a child's schooling for the effect to be maintained. So I guess literacy learning starts with oral language in the home. And then children learn how to engage with written language through reading and writing when they begin school. And that's where teachers come in. So oral language provides the starting point and continues across a lifetime, but it's what teachers do in classrooms that creates the opportunity for children to build on that oral language base. So my interest in this process of becoming literate and how it was easy for some but not for others was something that was in the back of my mind even as a student at school, particularly at high school, where I observed that some people, some of the students that were in the same year as I was, did not have the same opportunities as the students that I was with had. And that was something that sort of played in the back of my mind even before I became a teacher. But my observations and study helped to confirm that teachers' learning is the key to children's learning. I'm certainly not the only one to come to that conclusion. You know, John Hattie's well-known meta-analysis confirmed that the teacher was the key to children's learning at school. One observation that stayed with me was that teachers who were good at teaching writing as well as reading seemed to have students whose literacy was generally stronger than those teachers who were good at teaching reading but not so good at teaching writing. This is what led me to explore the learning and teaching of writing in a number of research studies.
Why is there a distinction? I would have imagined if you are good in reading, you would be equally as good in writing.
No, that's actually not the case. When we write, we examine text in a whole different way, and we create text. Mm. And to create text, you need to think in a whole different way. Creating text or writing is an inventive, creative process. This is where we share our thinking with other people. Whereas when we read, we are interpreting the texts created by others. Mm. Now, lots of people read but don't write.
Right.
But when you start to write, you actually note different things in texts as you read. They're reciprocal processes. And particularly with young children, what I noticed is that when the teacher was a really strong teacher of writing, those children seemed to notice text features differently when they read. I guess there's another way of thinking about it. You know, we can read without writing, but we cannot write without reading. So if you think about that for a moment, those teachers who are teaching writing well, their children have a double dose of reading opportunity. They're doing reading in their reading lessons, but they're also reading as they are writing in their writing lessons.
You explained that brilliantly. I'm thinking about an article you wrote together with Daphne in 2020, and it's titled The Challenges of Learning and Teaching English Spelling. And it was looking at the insights from, for insights from 8 Australian students and their teachers. You received an award for this, a prestigious literacy education award. But can you share what the paper was about?
Just briefly, because it's really quite complex, it's exploring the juxtaposition of students who are struggling with learning how to spell in English and teachers who are struggling with how to teach spelling. So you've got that interplay of a teacher who's unsure of how to teach spelling to struggling students and a child who is struggling to learn the complexities of spelling in English. So for a range of reasons, the 8 teachers in this study were lacking in confidence in their own spelling ability, and this impacted their confidence and skill as teachers of spelling. So many, you know, some of these teachers had histories of struggling with spelling themselves, and then when faced with children who were also struggling, I guess the interplay became a real issue for both the teacher and the students. So again, this study highlights the teachers being the key to the process of learning once you're at school. And to be a good teacher of spelling requires knowledge of the linguistics that underpin the written language, an understanding of curriculum expectations, and knowledge of effective teaching and assessment strategies, but also confidence in your own ability as a speller. And it was interesting when we explored the interviews that these teachers, they were quite successful with the majority of students in their class who did not have issues with learning to spell. They could cope with those students. But when it came to students who were struggling, they were really at a loss as to how to make a difference with those particular children.
Can you just give I'm really curious about that when you say that children with challenging, that they had some challenges. Can you just give an example of a child who has, there's a challenge with the spelling? What is the problem?
Now, see, there can be multiple problems, but I guess this is where the issue is very specific to English. English is not a phonetically regular language, and you know that from learning English as a second language. And many children who are lacking in confidence and skill in spelling try to rely on phonemics instead of applying morphological and orthographic patterns in spelling. And so if you try to use a phonemic approach, which seemed to be the dominant approach of these weaker students, and strangely enough, it seemed to also be the prompt that teachers were giving. These teachers who were struggling were prompting children to use phonemics when, in fact, phonemics was what the children were already using and it wasn't working. They needed alternate strategies. They needed to look at the morphological and orthographic patterns.
Right.
So it's that complexity of the English language. I know there are some languages where there's a fairly consistent relationship between letters and sounds. In English, that's not the case. We've got 26 letters, we've got 44 sounds, and then there's about 120 plus ways of recording those sounds, those letter combinations. And that doesn't include dialects, it doesn't include accents. So English is not a language where you can rely on phonemics, and yet struggling students seem to rely on this approach until they are explicitly taught alternate ways. And struggling teachers seem to fall back on trying to get children to use phonemics when they actually need to use more complex alternate approaches.
Right. So, and this is where, of course, professional development programs, do you support teachers in this?
Absolutely. Yes. Spelling's not so much my area. It's more Tessa's area, Tessa DeFern. Tessa was my PhD student, and she has done a lot of exceptional work in the area of supporting teachers in professional learning in the area of spelling.
But so your area is more the writing?
That's correct.
Okay.
And although Tessa and I have worked together quite closely, that's her area of specialty, whereas my area tends to be more early writing development. And in relation to a lot of my research, that is specifically the relationships between talking, drawing, and writing in the very early stages of writing. And I've done quite a bit of work with my colleague Janet Scull in the area of writing analysis. And in the writing analysis process, we've looked at helping teachers examine children's writing from both the transcription skills and the authorial skills.
And what role do parents, do you bring in parents in this support, or do you leave that up to the teachers of the children?
Parents are interesting. I personally have done a lot of work with parents over the years, particularly in the early years, the 4 to 8 year old area. But it comes back to usually to schools to determine what support they provide for parents. And sometimes they bring someone like me in. Other times they do it in-house with their staff. The Australian Literacy Educators Association, I've done sessions for parents through that association. It's very much a school leadership role, though. It's not the sort of thing that can be done from the outside in, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts about the literacy and numeracy test for initial teacher education students?
I have my concerns about this test. It's been introduced, I think, as a result of community distrust in what happens in teacher education courses. And perhaps from that point of view, it might help so that the universities can say all our accredited teachers have passed this test. But I personally am not convinced that it's necessary or that it's particularly helpful. I think it's interesting, and I couldn't comment on what's being done in all universities because I think they have different processes, but I think most universities do this very well. I guess it comes down to the requirements of a course and the supports that are available to teacher education students. So I don't think we do students any favours if we allow them to pass a course and then enter teaching without the skills and confidence to teach students how to become literate. And right across the board, I guess that brings us back to the teachers of spelling who were perhaps very confident teachers at teaching other areas, but they did not have the confidence or the knowledge that they needed to teach children to spell who were struggling with spelling. They were okay with most students, but they weren't with the strugglers. So I guess that's where it gets really quite demanding, the range, the diversity of needs of children in classrooms, which is why our teachers need to be very well prepared.
You have written an article about teaching handwriting and keyboarding in the current era. Can you share a little bit about the article and what role do you think digitalization and, if you like, edtech tools have in future teaching and learning?
That's a really interesting question. And I've actually written quite a lot about handwriting and keyboarding. And I've initially written about it in regard to early learning. And I worked with an occupational therapist in my work in this area. I think the study I'd like to go to in order to discuss this topic is a study that I conducted with the OT. Her name's Rebecca. And Rebecca and I surveyed and observed year seven students. So these students are in their first year of high school. And what we wanted to find out about was the expectations of high school in terms of their writing, but from the perspective of transcription skills. So we're talking purely here the ability to keyboard, the ability to write by hand, not the ability to construct a text of a particular genre. So we're looking particularly at transcription skills as enabling writing. So the two key transcription skills we're looking at here are handwriting and keyboarding. There is much research that's out there that demonstrates that handwriting is still critical for young children. And handwriting helps with thinking. It helps with noticing the detail in print. And that helps with reading. So there's direct relationships between learning how to write well by hand and being able to free the brain to concentrate on content, the working memory. So if a child is struggling with how to write, they can't think about what to write. So the handwriting's critical in those early years. And there's also research to indicate that even adults remember more of what we write by hand than what they write on a keyboard, which is really quite interesting. And those of us in our era, I think, Lisa, you're probably like me, you learnt to handwrite and then later you learnt to use a keyboard. And you probably, like me, go back and forth between the two different processes. This is what I've been arguing for quite some time now, that we need to give our children the same privilege of being able to select the tool for the task. So these children in year seven, what they told us was that, and we observed this, we did 5-minute observations in classrooms, teachers asked them to do both. So even if you're doing the same subject in year seven as another group in year seven, because there might be five classes all doing science, three teachers might be really keen on using the keyboard and two teachers might be still asking children to use the handwriting to record their notes. what we found in this particular study is that these children had come through primary school without strong skills in either handwriting or keyboarding. There's been an assumption that because children are using phones and they play games on the computer and they've got tablets in their hands all the time, that they don't need to be taught how to use a keyboard and, in, I guess we could call it touch typing. It doesn't have to be perfect touch typing, but it needs to be efficient. And it also needs to be linked to how to use keystrokes and how to organise documents and files. All of these things are factored in together. And what we saw were Year 7 children who, in many cases, typed with two fingers, had created a new file every time they started some new work. They didn't know how to name the files. They didn't know how to organise the files. So they had a screen full of files. But more importantly, they couldn't keep up. So they weren't taking notes in class. They couldn't keep up in terms of writing fast enough by hand, and they couldn't keep up in terms of keyboarding fast enough to take notes. So we saw many Year 7 children who were taking no notes in class at all, except for the odd photograph of the teacher's screen. Now, when I talked to the kids about that, they said, oh, yeah, it's a bit of a... I said, what do you do with these screenshots you're taking and with these photographs? And quite a few of them said, well, I always think I'm going to organise them and download them, but half the time when I run out of space on my phone, I just dump them. And I thought, okay. But the other interesting thing we found in another study conducted by one of my PhD students is that the use of the keyboard, and in this reference is in terms of creating documents, the students, because they had access to the keyboard and the internet, where they're overwhelmed with information, they are cutting and pasting. And in some cases, what they're doing is they're cutting a piece of text. It's the first piece of text they find with a quick search.
Gosh.
Then what they do is they either use a software program to reorganize the words, or they change a few words, and then they go to the next piece of information. And they do what's sometimes referred to as patch writing, which is, you know what a patchwork is, where we pull a lot of things together and we stitch them together. That's what they're doing. Instead of creating a text, they're patch writing. So what we've got here is a whole lot of issues that are really complex, and we could do a whole other podcast just on this topic, Lisa.
Wow, it's such an interesting area. Today, working as an independent education consultant, you made the transition from the university and as an academic. What made you decide making the transition, and are there times when you miss working as an academic?
I'm still connected to the university as an adjunct. I'm an adjunct associate professor. And I do still have one PhD student, but you're quite right. I'm mainly working as an independent consultant and have been for the last 2 years. But I worked as a professional development provider before I became an academic. And as my research has always been connected to teacher learning, both my master's, my doctorate, and the research I conducted at the university, I've continued to do teacher professional development work related to my research while I was working at the university, often through the Australian Literacy Educators Association. Interestingly, my work with schools and teachers was recognised and highlighted towards the end of my full-time academic career as evidence of research impact. And I found that rather interesting because for a lot of my academic career, I was discouraged from doing this work, and it was always on top of my workload. Yes, yes, interesting. But that's the reality. I was encouraged to research and write, but not necessarily take that work back into schools. But my commitment was always that if you research with people, you owe them not just to share your findings, but to work with them to move forward from those findings and from the learning, which is why all my research has been conducted with teachers in schools. I do miss working with uni students sometimes, although there were times when I wished that they would come to uni for 3 years, then have a full year in the field and then come back. Then their understandings of what they needed to learn would be more realistic. And it worried me that some of our students were more focused on their assessments and just passing the course instead of what they needed for their career. But I think that's partly because you never quite know what you need to know until you're right in the middle of it. And I also think the shift of having so many students who were working to pay their way through uni, so they're doing part-time uni and part-time work, was really hard for students to balance. That was something that when I was a young student, I didn't have to worry about that. My scholarship made sure that I had enough money to live on and all my fees paid. I also found towards the end of my career that the syllabus requirements of what I had to teach was becoming narrow and more controlled by accrediting bodies. And at times this meant that I wasn't even able to share my own research or new research from other researchers, which was quite frustrating. When I work with teachers, I'm invited to use my own research and experience, and they are able to focus on how my work can help them in their teaching role. So I guess the hybrid approach to teaching at uni has had many advantages and allows the expertise of some to share, you know, some people who have particular expertise can be shared more widely. But I worried about things like recordings. I know there's recordings that I made 5 years or more ago that are still being used. That concerns me because they haven't been updated. You know, and I think another problem that was occurring was that people were facilitating the use of videos or podcasts with students, but they didn't have the background knowledge to answer students' questions with in a deep way, and that this was leading to frustration, and that was something that was concerning me greatly.
Thank you.
me, what do you think will attract more highly suitable people to become teachers?
Oh, that is such a tricky question. I think, see, one of the areas that I investigated in my doctoral work related to teacher morale. And I think at the moment we've got quite a lot of teachers out there, particularly with COVID, who are suffering from poor morale. And so I think the profession at itself needs to consider how they are going to look at what it means to be a teacher in the current era. Now, I'm just trying to find my notes so that I can refer to this accurately, because it's a long time since I've actually talked about this particular topic. But in my work on morale, I identified three particular aspects of teacher morale. The first was personal morale, and that was determined by a teacher's personal situation. So things like health, family situation, financial stability, relationships, those sorts of things. Then there's school morale. School morale is the day-to-day experiences of the teacher in their particular school and local community. So I call that school morale. And the third is the professional morale. And that's the morale that's inextricably intertwined with the status of teaching as a profession. And what I've argued is that personal morale, school morale, and professional morale are intertwined. And so, you know, the old idea that you could take the staff out at the end of term and give them a lovely meal and buy them a few drinks and that would lift their morale, that would probably make a difference to school morale, but it's not necessarily going to have any impact on personal morale or the professional morale. That's the teaching as a profession. So attracting teachers to teaching, I think we need to look at what it is that is impacting the morale of the profession. So why are teachers not respected anymore? They were highly respected when I trained. So why aren't they highly respected? Why are we requiring more and more accountability measures? Why is assessment becoming more an external thing developed by outside bodies and measured and marked by outside bodies instead of trusting teachers in schools and in classrooms to assess the needs of their students? So I think that it's a complex process. Some might say that salary, improving salary might make a difference, but I don't think so. The starting salary is not a problem for a teacher. It's quite a nice amount to start on in an Australian situation. It stops, though, after about 10 or 12 years. It's looking at what happens to a teacher's career, not what their starting salary is, and what alternatives do they have. In the past, if you wanted to get to the top of the salary scale, you had to go into administration and become a principal, for example, instead of being able to stay in a leadership role. There are more leadership roles that are curriculum-based now, and I think this is a really positive move. For example, most systems now have either instructional leaders, they sometimes call them, sometimes they call them quality teaching leads. They're curriculum instructors. There's a range of different titles. And these people are in positions of support and mentorship in terms of teaching and learning. And I think that's really exciting. So attracting excellent teachers or potentially excellent teachers maybe it's about helping the community and helping share information with high school students or potential teacher education students in what the career paths might be if you go into teaching, and that there are career paths that are varied. I mean, if I look at my own career, it's in sort of three main sections, I guess. But I had about 12 years as a classroom teacher, then 15 years in teacher professional learning, and then 15 years in academia, and now I'm back working in teacher professional learning. There were trips and working overseas. I mean, if I think now, those kinds of career paths, if more teachers or potential teachers knew that there were possibilities like that, maybe there'd be more interest in becoming a teacher. You know, I think we just need to promote what we do and value what we do, and then think about how those in the service now are being supported.
Yes.
So that their morale is high, so that when they are talking about their career, when they're out in the community, they are doing it from a positive perspective.
That's right.
Sharing positive stories, sharing the richness. You know, it's the best career in the world as far as I'm concerned.
And if not the most important one.
Absolutely the most important one. It's and I guess if I go back to your question before, why have I gone back to professional learning? I strongly believe it's the teacher in the classroom that makes the difference. And the teacher's ongoing learning determines how effective they are, and they need support. They need ongoing, well thought out, well researched support. And I guess I'm also excited at the moment that quite often I'm working with these instructional leaders and these quality teaching leaders who are then supporting the teachers in the classroom. So I'm really excited about that, because they can have an ongoing impact on the classroom teacher. I can come and I can help for a period of time, but it's those people that keep the ball rolling.
Is it about skills or is it about pedagogy to be a good teacher?
Oh, now that's a really interesting question, because teaching, to me, the two most important ingredients are relationships, the ability to form relationships, and that's with children, that's with families, and it's also with colleagues. Being able to work collaboratively. So relationships are going to be key. And I think that's something that can be worked on, but it's almost a prerequisite skill when somebody comes to learn how to be a teacher. They need to be able to form relationships. The second thing I think that is critical, and a lot of work can be done on this when they are at university, and that's communication skills. The ability to communicate with each of those groups that I mentioned, the students, the families, and colleagues. So those two ingredients to me are the most important. Then I think a teacher has to have a belief in their own ability to teach, And they need some a theoretical framework that informs the decisions they make. They need to be able to say to parents and students, we're doing this because, and this happens because. And that doesn't mean that they all need to have the same theoretical framework. I actually think it's healthy for children, for students in schools, if they work with teachers who come from different perspectives. I think if we can then provide the support and the resources, and, you know, I've worked with different theoretical frameworks, I've worked with different pedagogical approaches, I've definitely worked with different curriculum documents in different places over my lengthy career. And I think it comes down to the teacher's interpretation of what it is they have to teach, but then how to relate that to the students that are in their care at this point in time. So know your students. That comes back to relationships and it comes back to communication. Know what you have to teach and have a number of different pathways that will get you from A to B, because not all children are going to travel the same pathway. So a good teacher has a range of pathways. They know how to say, let's come back and try that again, and this time we'll go this direction. So I think a teacher needs to be an ongoing learner. They need to realize that they didn't stop learning when they got their first teaching job. They actually had just started their learning, and that it will continue during their entire career. In my case, I completed both my master's and my doctorate while I was working full-time as a professional development provider for the New South Wales Department of Education. And I did both of those because I wanted to know more about how to do my job well. So I enrolled in my master's, and what I looked at in my master's was what made effective professional development of teachers, because I was working in that role and I wanted to do it better. And through the department, the in-service work I was getting was more focused on children. And I personally wanted to focus on teachers because they were my students, if you want to put it that way. So I guess a teacher is going to be seeking out the learning that is going to help them do their job better, not just waiting for somebody to dish it up to them. A good teacher, in terms of their learning, will usually belong to a professional association. And they might belong in an active role, or they might belong in a role that means they just participate in what's professional learning is offered, and they have access to research articles and professional learning articles. So that idea that as a teacher, you are always a learner. So I guess if I was to summarise it, I'd say relationships, the ability to form and maintain healthy relationships, communication skills, and then commitment to being a learner, and that all of those things help you to be a teacher.
Fantastic. Do you have anything you want to add that you are concerned about or that you consider of great importance to bring up?
Goodness. At this stage, Lisa, I guess I'd like to just go back to what excites me. And I guess in my particular role, I firmly believe it's good teachers that enable students to become literate. And as I mentioned earlier, I'm excited that I'm not just working with teachers, but I'm working with their mentors. And I think that notion that we need mentors, instructional supports in schools, that's been, I think, one of the most positive shifts during my career, because When I started, there were teachers and then there were assistant principals and principals who mainly maintained administrative roles, whereas the recognition that we need these people to support teachers in their learning and their roles at a curriculum and an instructional level, I find that really exciting. And having the privilege to work with those people and have them seek me out, have them come to me and say, can you help us with this? To me, that's, I guess, the icing on the cake, you could put it that way. I've had an amazing career, and to be able to do this at this point in my career, to help these people, is a real privilege. So I don't think it's all doom and gloom. I think there's some really good things happening. There's some strange things happening, but that's okay. We'll work through that. People, there's so many good people out there. They'll work through that. We'll come out the other end and we'll be stronger as a profession. And I just hope that more and more, I've worked with some very exciting young teachers in recent times, and they give me the confidence that, you know, there are good things happening.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Noella, for your time, your generosity this morning. It's been an absolute pleasure listen to you, and have a fantastic weekend.
Oh, thank you, Lisa.
And you have been listening to the podcast Sånt är livet i Sverige, or in English, That's Life Here in Sweden, with me, Lisa Orsimäki. Till next time, take care of yourself and each other. Bye for now.